I knew it. I knew it. I have a recording black cloud here. All right. Well, so there's no ant monitoring, is there enough food? There's no ant monitoring the food I just took and I'm hauling it back. How much did I leave behind? And how long are we gonna need this food line? That's not happening. They're just responding to local cues, either the food they bump into or the pheromones from other ants. When you're walking down the street, there's no one from City Hall saying, okay, people, the sidewalk's getting crowded, start forming two lines, one going one way. You're just responding to the way your eyes meet the other people. And you start to adjust your body movement, and other people see your body starting to adjust, and the flow down the sidewalk changes. It's all about local sensing. Next. And then the best thing is that there has to be low-level randomness in the system. The jargon term for this is, next slide, quench disorder. So if you have the ants are, you know, they have their food line, but then the food runs out, what happens? Sort of chaos, because all the ants were in the line. They don't know what to do. So the whole thing sort of breaks up. There goes your organization. Next slide. Next. But if you look really closely at any ant line, there's always a few ants, like 2 to 5%, that aren't following the line. And these ants that you can do this in real living systems, or you can computer model this, if you put your foot down here, and put your foot in the middle of the line, it's not these ants in the line that rapidly find a route around your foot. It's the ants not following the line that find the new route and begin laying down pheromone trails that the other ants start to respond to. It's these ants that are likely to find another food source even while this one is being harvested. And when they find another food source, they start laying down pheromone trails. Other ants that aren't on this line will cross them and go, oh, I hear there's food that way, and a new line starts to form. If you have too much randomness in the system, that you'd get no self-organization. You can't form a food line at all. The whole thing can't be random ants. But if you don't have any ants, when the food source runs out, when the environment changes, there's no adaptation. So it's this low-level randomness that allows the possibility of new options to adapt to a changing environment. And that's what makes things alive, whether it's a living city, a living body made of cells, et cetera. Next slide. And so the difference between recognizing this randomness or not is all about how close do you get to the line. If you don't bother bending down, then you think, wow, ant lines are like this. These are the ants that find the food. No, these are the ants that are carrying the food that another ant found. And when you look closely, you see these other ants. That's the quench disorder in the system. Yes?
These renegades come just from the numbers, right? There's nothing different about these particular ants.
Good question. Someone always asks that, and I always remember, gee, I should have mentioned that before someone asked me. Yes, there is nothing special about a divergent ant or a renegade. They're going to be part of the next food line. And then they're just gonna be food line ants. And some of these other ants are gonna be the divergent ants. So you can make this a metaphor for artists and poets in society, et cetera. And I think to some extent that's true. But even artists and poets can be dead-ended, slavish devotees of a style that no longer functions in society. And you know, who's gonna buy that book? So the metaphorical aspect of this you have to be careful with, but it's still apt. But there is nothing special about one ant versus another, right?
So then why does one ant just go do that and another ant doesn't?
It depends on whether you crossed the pheromone set that told you, hey, there's food over here. If you didn't cross some other ant's path that had laid down the trail to tell you, follow me, then you're just out wandering. But the moment you bump into the food, that turns on a chemical signal, which the ants put down 9 pheromones. And they can tell directionality because each one decays at a certain rate. So stronger, if you go in the direction that it's stronger, that tells you that's where it is most recently laid down. And so there's an arrow to the pheromone trails. Yeah, it's really cool. and the fact that mathematically it doesn't matter whether we're talking about ants or humans or buffalo herds or flocks of birds. I was in Kyoto. Let's keep an eye on the time here. We'll speed it up. I was in Kyoto, there was a garden, there was wisteria, and there was this thick branch, and there were two lines of ants going up on the outside and one line of ants coming down in the middle. And I thought, wow, that's cool, very nice. And I actually made a video of it in case I wanted a video for talking about ants. I never learned how to use that, but so it didn't go. But then I came home and I hit the Delancey Essex Street subway stop at just the right time of day where there are so many people coming. It's a wider staircase there than normal. And I watched as there were two rows of people going up and one row of people coming down in the middle. It's exactly the same. We think, well, we're humans, we have ideas. Next slide. But we have this idea. So this is how you draw cell lineages. If you're doing biology, cell biology, and stem cell biology, which is one of my things, one cell at the far end divides, gives rise to two cells. Those divide and give rise to more cells. And the different colors indicate different tissues, different organs, et cetera. So this is a way of diagramming that. And it's always been thought to be unidirectional and hierarchical. And once a cell makes a fate decision, moving left to right, following one branch or the other, it can never go back. And the research I started doing 17 years ago now in stem cell plasticity showed that, in fact, when you use more sophisticated techniques and look more closely, when you stoop down to actually look at what's happening, there's a small number of cells that are not following the lines, and they're bouncing across boundaries. And so we started to realize that cells organizing into bodies, tissues, organs, and bodies, is the same thing as an ant colony organizing, ants organizing into a colony, or humans organizing into a culture. What we were discovering is the low-level randomness in the system. Next slide. Now, a neat thing about this is the mathematics makes it inevitable that if you have an adaptive, self-organizing system that's alive, it will inevitably, at some point, suffer a mass extinction event. And either a large piece of it or the whole thing will wipe out. Next slide. So you could diagram perfect order, billiard balls that are utterly predictable, perfect disorder, molecules in a gas, totally unpredictable, or fractal chaos. And these are three ways of things that can organize themselves. And it turns out that mathematically complex systems, next slide, lie in this zone here. And so you'd think that you can plot mathematically any complex system. The ant colony would be described as this point here. But it's not, because there's quench disorder in the system. There's always a little bit of randomness. So instead, next slide, it wanders around in this zone. And inevitably, given enough time, it will step out of the zone to one side or the other, next slide, and suffer a mass extinction event. So the very mathematical thing that makes a system alive and adaptive, that quench disorder, also at the same time guarantees that ultimately it will suffer a mass extinction event and die. Next slide. Oh, never mind that. Next slide. So the price of adaptation, of being alive, is to die. There is no escaping, there's no fountain of youth, there's no eternal life, et cetera, et cetera. If you're alive, it means necessarily you're going to die. Next. Another interesting thing about this is you can think of hierarchies of complex systems, which you've already hinted at. Next slide. So you have an ant colony, you see it on the floor of the desert, and you see it moving around a little bit, but you know it's an ant colony. You don't have to go. But if you go in and inspect it more closely, you see there are ants. Well, ants are bodies made of cells, and I've already said that cells are just like ants or humans that are self-organizing, but they're doing it at the microscopic level. So if you go to the ant body close-up, what you see are cells. Just as when you look at the ants, the colony ceases to exist, when you look at the cells, the ant ceases to exist. At this level of scale, I have a hand. But if we look at the microscopic level, it's just a flock of cells self-organizing into something that, if we come back, looks like a hand. But it's not. Next slide. So whether or not something appears to be a thing, as opposed to a phenomenon arising from smaller things, depends on the scale of observation. Next slide. So from a distance, a bait ball of fish looks like a solid object. A flock of birds looks like a solid object. It's moving. But if you don't really know what it is at first, you might go, what's that thing? And then you recognize, oh, it's birds. Oh, it's a bunch of fish. And then each of those fish, if we go down to the microscopic level, well, it's a fish, right? Not at the cellular level, it's just a flock of cells. And at the cellular level, this hand isn't even entirely human. If you can't do it by number of cells, it's maybe 1% to 10% human, and the rest is bacteria. So your human body that you think of as yourself, as this thing, and you're a bunch of bodies listening to this body, but the fact is that none of our bodies would function without the bacteria that line your skin. You have specific bacteria that line the creases of your skin. They're different from all of us, but they all are the same class of bacteria, and what they do is they feed on dying cells of the skin and make lanolin, which lubricates the fold there, and that's why your skin doesn't break down, even though you're bending your skin all the time. And a baby gets that from their mom at birth. If they didn't, their skin would be breaking down within a day or two, and they would die of bacterial infection. You cannot live without your bacteria. You are not a functioning human without your bacteria. And your digestive tract, the villi in the digestive tract that allow you to absorb food, there are these fine little projections at the top of cells. They're almost nanoscopic in scale. Boy in the bubble, or a mouse raised in an abiotic environment with no bacteria, they can't absorb food because they have no villi. And then if you add bacteria into their digestive tract, then the villi form. So you go from flat, add bacteria, villi. Your body, your genes do not code the structure and architecture of the villi. They code for the interaction with the bacteria out of which arise the functional capacity of your digestive tract. You are not a human without the majority of cells in your body that are not human. So are you a human or are you a bunch of cells that are a mix of bacteria and human? And both are correct, depending on what your scale of observation is. Next. And so this, whoops. The fact that both are correct, even though only one can be seen at one time, is what we call complementarity. Next slide. So it's like one of these images. Is it two faces or is it a vase? Well, it's both, but you can only see the vase or the two faces. And this has been studied with fMRI machines, et cetera. If you are trying to see them both simultaneously, what you're really doing is just rapidly going back and forth between them. You can't see them both at the same time. But you know that if you say it's a vase, the description is incomplete. Oh, so it's two faces. No, that's incomplete. It has to be both. And this is exactly the same. Manas, my collaborator on the awareness paper, he's a quantum physicist and cosmologist. We've written a separate paper on this topic saying that this is exactly the same. This is what complementarity of wave-particle duality of quantum physics is. This is the way that complementarity exists at higher levels of scale. And it's the same thing. Next. So, given all that, we're now going to extend it out just beyond the biological. Next slide. So, what we've already described, cells self-organize into bodies, which self-organize into communities, and depending on what you consider a body, you get a different type of community. Next slide. Cities, cultures, ecosystems, Gaia. Next. Next. But cells self-organize from biomolecules, and I could do a whole 15 minutes on how this is exactly the same thing. If you want to know more about that, go check my website and dig out for papers or ask me about it later, and we can go into it in more detail. But cells are just have no inherent identity either. When we say Western medicine and Western biology, what we mean is the biology and medicine defined by the idea of cell doctrine, that all bodies are made of cells which derive from other cells. And that's what we mean by Western. But the fact is that cells also have no inherent existence the way an ant body doesn't, the way an ant colony doesn't. Cells are just self-organizing biomolecules in water. And what provides the quench disorder? The temperature of that water. If you get too hot, if you have a fever, you can't live because there's now too much randomness in the system of the biomolecules organizing into cells, and they start to break down. If your body temperature goes too low, there's not enough movement to give you enough disorder to adapt and survive. That's why your body temperature is important. It's about quench disorder. Next slide. And biomolecules come from self-organizing atoms, and atoms come from self-organizing subatomic particles. And those come from whatever the smallest thing is. And the big theory we hear about is strings, but it's not the only theory out there. And there's a lot of argument as to what the smallest thing is. But after whatever this layer is, there's no argument to the fact that there's nothing smaller. So have we arrived at the thing that is actually a thing and not subject to complementarity? No, because it turns out that whatever these things are, they're coming in and out of the vacuum in what's called the quantum foam. So space and time, space-time, are the space in which we live. That's one way of looking at it. And it's never empty. It's never actually a vacuum that's completely empty. It's always inherently energy-rich. And energy equals mc squared inevitably gives rise to matter. And when it does that, it usually does it as matter-antimatter pairings, and so they come into existence and then annihilate and sink back into the quantum foam. But every once in a while, they don't. And when that happens, they can interact with each other. And so some of those things that survive the annihilation interact with each other to become the smallest things, which become subatomic particles, which become atoms, which become molecules, which becomes the entire universe. So there's no place in the universe where there's a thing that exists from every perspective you look at it. Everything is either a thing or a process, except the bottom things, which are also thing or process, arising out of emptiness. Now, I shouldn't use a Buddhist term. Arising out of the vacuum. Next slide. So there, I've just described the entire universe as a self-organizing system, and the mathematics of self-organization apply to the entire universe. And that brings us to things like emptiness and the non-materiality of material beings. Next slide. That stuff. Next. But notice that, back one. I could do Lurianic Kabbalah, I could do Hindu metaphysics, I could do Sufism, I could do shamanic things from different cultures. All of this maps to all of those, and we've written about that too. Next slide. So, at this level of scale, the relative, there's a dog sitting in front of a house. There are people in a room listening to one person go on and on and on. Next slide. But from the realm of the absolute, that's the other end of the scale. There's space. Everything that comprises our substance is arising from at least that energy-filled, energy-rich vacuum that's giving rise to everything that self-organizes upwards. From the point of view of that level of scale, there's no separation. There's no difference between one thing and another. It's all one seamless whole. The universe isn't a box in which we live, the prior slide. We are the universe. We are the universe self-organizing into beings that think of themselves as separate. But from this level of scale, there's no separation. Next slide. The idea that thingness is dependent on scale is exactly what is meant, next slide, as the emptiness of inherent existence. Nothing has inherent existence. Bodies don't, cities don't, cells don't, molecules don't, subatomic particles don't. There's nothing that is, from every perspective, a thing that... a thing. End of sentence. Next slide. The inevitability of mass extinction events, next. That's impermanence. Next slide. Systems depend on every member. Next. That's interdependence. Next. And the fact that emergence is predictable, but because of the quench disorder in the system, you can't predict precisely what form it will take. You can only say self-organization that's adaptive will happen, but you can't actually predict what it will be. That's what's meant by karmic law. Next. And so this is another way to diagram this. The quantum vacuum gives rise to the quantum foam, which gives rise to subatomic particles, atoms, et cetera, all the way onto the largest scale structures of the universe. And in quantum physics, we know when you're down in the quantum realm, Non-locality governs. This is where the complementarity of particles versus waves predominates. If you say an electron is a point, you're right. But if you do the experiment differently, no, that point doesn't exist in a spot. It's actually smeared over the entire universe, extending infinitely in all directions. And so at the quantum level, there is no inside and outside between these interacting agents. Everything is non-local. Everything is overlapping with everything else in a seamless whole. And so we talk about materiality to indicate that something is separate from something else. I can knock on this table because I'm material and the table is material. But we know that all of this is existing at the same time at the quantum level, in which case we're just part of an infinite continuum. And there you can't talk about, there you can't talk about materiality, which you're at this level of scale. There's no such thing as materiality, because you're in the realm of the non-local. So we are both material and non-material necessarily by this scheme. So if you followed me this far and were nodding, then you now have to go to the next slide.
What does non-local mean?
Non-local means that your boundaries extend to the outer extent of the universe. Good, yeah. So I'm sorry, I was wondering like, oh, do I pull in a video to explain this stuff? We'd be here for another hour. Well, half an hour. This idea that if you, depending on how you do an experiment looking how light behaves, it will either behave like particles or like waves. And it all is on your choice of experiment. When something behaves as a wave, mathematically, it is extending out to the full extent of the universe. When you define it as a particle, you're saying it's a bounded structure. And so some aspect of it, depending on how you look at it, has no boundaries. And that's what we mean by non-local. And since every single thing has no boundaries with every other thing, it's just a seamless whole. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. We ourselves are non-material beings, in theory and in fact. And since I'm giving this talk in a Zendo, I'll pull a quote I used in my first ever Dharma talk. From the Vimalakirti Sutra, chapter 7, Manjushri, who's the non-material bodhisattva sitting on the altar over there, says to Vimalakirti, who was a lay practitioner who was said to have all the attainment of the Buddha himself. And Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, how does the bodhisattva regard living beings? And Vimalakirti replies, as a conjurer looks on the beings he conjures up, thus does the bodhisattva regard living beings. As the wise view the moon and the water. It's not the moon, but it kind of is the moon. Or a face or form seen in a mirror, as shimmers of heat in a torrid season, as foam on the water, as the tracks of a bird in the sky, as sights in a dream after one has wakened. So you thought you were going to come in and hear about ghosts and stuff, and the most important thing I'm going to tell you is you think of yourself as a material being, and you are for most of your day, but you're also not, ever. Everything is non-material. The universe is non-material. Materiality is perspective dependent. Next slide. But what about actual non-material beings, the stuff you wanted to hear about? Next. So first, Manas Kafatos and I, he's my collaborator, we didn't stop there. We started to stop there at the quantum foam, but then we realized that was not sufficient. And where we finally went, next slide, is to say that in fact the quantum vacuum is not a thing either. That below that is pure awareness. Awareness of awareness. Non-duality. Awareness that has no object and subject. And when that awareness makes a shift into becoming, preparing to become aware of itself, to differentiate within itself into subject and object, into dual reality, then necessarily, if you're going to have that sort of separation, you have to have separation in space, and you have to have separation in time. And so you get space-time. And so non-duality gives rise to space-time, which is an energy-rich field, which then produces these particles that look real but are not, and all of that self-organizes into the entire universe. So our crazy idea is that actually the universe is just fundamental awareness that turns itself into this thing for whatever reason. Next slide. Oh, and that's the paper. If you want to read up on this stuff, that's the paper I would refer to. Next slide. Next slide. But it turns out it's not just our crazy idea. If you actually look at Western civilization as it stands today and a whole bunch of other civilizations, the idea that all of this is crazy comes a little bit from Descartes, but mostly from the Vienna Circle, a group of overly influential and totally wrong philosophers from Vienna who you've never heard about, and that's a whole other talk. But the fact is that from Plato through Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Gödel, Whitehead, the main streams of Western philosophy say are idealist, meaning there is no material world. It only appears to be a material world. The world is an ideal substance. Spinoza called it the one substance, and that's what he meant by God or nature. So Western philosophy isn't opposed to this idea. Only that little clutch who sort of got their hands around our throats culturally turned it into that. If you want to ask me about that, that's a whole story. A really good one. Scientifically, all the founders of quantum mechanics say the primary implication of quantum mechanics is you can't get behind consciousness. Consciousness is what allows the universe to form into the form it presents itself in. Without an observer, there's no collapse of the wave function. As I say, things do not become things. Relativity, and then I'm pointing out complex systems, is pointing in the same direction. The only thing from Western science that says otherwise is Newtonian mechanics. The thing is, Newton himself wrote far more words about alchemy than he ever did about physics. So let's not put that on his plate, okay? And then from a metaphysical point of view, find me a system that doesn't ground itself in this idea. And all of these represent cultural traditions in which you can cultivate personal experiences so that it's not an idea, but it's an actual experience of the fundamental awareness and emptiness of existence and all the implications of that. So what I'm telling you, actually, in our little society at this part of the 21st century for about the last 70 years, since the Vienna Circle got evacuated to the rest of the planet because Hitler invaded Austria, it's a really entertaining story. Because of that, we think this is crazy. But the fact is, all these cultural, human cultural traditions, including ours, say this isn't crazy. Next slide. And that brings us to dark matter and energy. We're in the home stretch. And I just could not bear to actually try and make PowerPoint of this. So I have to explain to you what dark matter and energy are, and I left the pen in here. But you can still follow my voice. Now, see, aren't you having an experience of a non-material being now? Oh, does anyone know where the really great green marker went? Oh. We're almost there. I think we've got like 10 more minutes to go. Ooh. Okay, so turn out that light, please. Can you see over there if I do? Okay. So dark matter. Okay, has everyone heard of dark matter?
Yes.
Has everyone heard of dark energy?
Yes.
Anyone think they can explain it?
No.
Okay. It's really easy. So dark matter, so what we mean by dark matter is we can't see it. That's all. There's no moral or metaphorical thing. Oh, it's dark, the dark arts. It's just that we can't see it with our senses, either alone or enhanced by the machines we've made, like telescopes. Oh, thank you, Yuka. So someone noticed there's a problem with the galaxy. This is distance, and this is speed, and this is Mercury. It's very close to the sun, small distance, and it's going around the sun very fast, right? And then we have Venus, and Earth, and Mars, and Jupiter, and, oh God, Uranus? Oh, Saturn, I forgot Saturn. Uranus and Neptune? I can't believe, this is humiliating. Well, I know, but that's, you know, that's not a planet. But okay, Pluto. Is it Uranus and Neptune or Neptune and Uranus?
Uranus, Neptune.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, that's pathetic. Okay. This is Newton's law of gravity. The farther away you get, the slower things go. And so this woman named Vera Rubin, who had four kids and was a professional cosmologist and really didn't have time to go wandering around to different telescopes around the world because she was raising her kids, wanted a problem that no one else was paying attention to. And she thought that she could use the scope where she was raising her children. And what she thought was, well, we should be able to demonstrate this for the galaxy. Spiral galaxies rotate, right? So the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. That's not a very good spiral, sorry. The Andromeda galaxy right next door is the same. So she got her telescope pointed to the Andromeda galaxy and expected to see the center of the galaxy rotating very quickly. And the further out you go, it's rotating more slowly. That's not what she saw. It does that. Well, the only way to explain that is there's got to be more mass there. There's got to be this. The sun is the big thing that's holding all this in, and then there's a lot of empty space. So each of these things has its relationship to the sun, creating this typical sort of pattern. But if the galaxy isn't doing that, then there must be a whole bunch of mass out here that's keeping it going. So that's dark matter. We can't see it. We can see the stars. But when you add up the mass of all the stars, and she was doing calculations, other people were doing calculations like this, it didn't add up enough to explain why the outside of the galaxy was rotating as fast as the inside of the galaxy. So then people started, and this is an awful story, because why did she not win the Nobel Prize for this? Because she was a woman. And the case has been made very strongly, and there was a very strong push to get her a Nobel Prize before she died, and she died, I think, a year and a half ago without ever having won it. But that's a whole other thing. So Vera Rubin,
She's in the hyper.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, no, she's on the dark energy side. So people then were like, well, what could be the dark matter? And they thought, well, planets. Not enough planets. What about interstellar dust? Well, when you use telescopes to look at interstellar dust, it doesn't add up. You still only have like 5%. What about hydrogen atoms, which is the most common atom in the universe? So what they found was, if you have the galaxy, there's a cloud of hydrogen that extends that far beyond the galaxy. So it's this vast cloud of hydrogen. So maybe if you all add up all that hydrogen, so it's like a globe, that adds up to enough. No, that gets you to 7%. There's just not enough to explain how the galaxy keeps moving like that. And so there's got to be something else, and there isn't anything else we can recognize. Therefore, it's dark matter. What we know is it can interact with us via gravity, because all the effects we're recognizing are gravitational effects. And so the thought is that you can infer where the mass is by the shape of everything, largely the distribution of the hydrogen, and we can infer that the galaxy sits in a globe of dark matter like that, and that's what gives everything its shape and function. So dark matter, dark energy, and the matter and energy we know, our matter and energy that we know comprises about 6% of the universe, dark matter about 40% of the universe, and the rest is dark energy. So the things that we see as the universe are a profoundly small component of the actual universe. And then what is the dark matter comprised of? No one knows. The most people will say is that maybe they're WIMPs, which I like, because I grew up in West Hartford, Connecticut, and we had the West Hartford Individualized Math Program, at which I excelled, which made sense. But WIMP, W-I-M-P, not W-H-I-M-P, is weakly interactive massive particles. So they speculate that whatever it is, there are these massive particles, kind of like the God particle, but weakly interactive, and that's what's out there, and no one's ever found such a particle, but they're presumed to exist. That's dark matter. Dark energy. Well, there's another funny thing about the universe no one knows how to explain. So the universe, Big Bang, starts as a small thing, and the galaxies get bigger and further apart. And that should stay constant as it expands, or slow down. But it's not. It's getting faster. So the bigger the universe gets, the faster the galaxies fly away from each other, the faster they fly away from each other. So there will come a point where there's nothing around our galaxy as far as the edges of the known universe. It will be empty except for our galaxy, which is a depressing thought. But that's billions of years away, so don't get too caught up in it. What's making it expand faster? No one knows, but it's got to be energy. But we don't know how to detect it, so it's dark energy. We know how much is there because we know how fast things are moving, so we know how much energy that takes, but we don't know what it is. It might simply be the energy of the quantum vacuum that I talked about before, and that's one theory, but there are other theories. So that's dark matter and energy. Any questions?
Is anyone on the verge of a test that will find, identify a particle?
No. But, there are lots of people trying. This is like after the God particle business, which don't ask me to explain tonight. But after that, this is the next big thing, dark matter and dark energy. If someone can identify the nature of those entities, it will be gigantic. And that woman may actually win a Nobel Prize. And she'll talk about Vera Rubin in her speech. Okay.
Channel.
Yes, exactly. We're almost done. Next slide. So this is my construct for the universe that no right-minded person who's unprejudiced will deny is at least a possibility. And that's all Manas and I, we're very conservative. We're not saying this is the way things are. We're just saying that there's nothing in contemporary science and Western philosophy that says that this is wrong, that this can't be. So this is a real possibility. Cultural prejudices say no, but next slide. But there's all this other stuff. And when they talk about wimps and dark energy, they always talk about it as though it's this inert stuff. But just because it can't interact with us through electromagnetism, the weak force, the strong force, the nuclear forces, only by gravity, why can't it interact with itself? It seems even maybe kind of crazy that it wouldn't be able to interact with itself. And if it can interact with itself, the way our smallest things are, whatever they are, they're going to turn into smallest dark matter energy things, which are going to turn into smaller dark matter, larger self-organized structures, which turn into larger self-organized structures, which turn into larger self-organized structures. And there's something about the mathematics of self-organization that leads to this hierarchy that emerges no matter how you set it up. The computer models, if you have computers that are powerful enough, it's really hard to get three levels up, but you can get two. It's virtually inevitable that it just keeps running higher and higher if you give it enough steam and the temperature's correct, et cetera. So we don't know what the structures are, but it's certainly possible that dark matter and dark energy are forming themselves into larger scale structures, some of which at least are living and sentient. They're living and sentient. They're living because they're self-organizing adaptive systems. They're just very different from ours, presumably. But why not? And sentience, that's a whole other argument that would take another hour, but sentience is what drives this whole thing. Next slide. Now we know this stuff exists because we can, when it clumps together in huge amounts, we can see the gravitational effects. But we've got no other way to communicate with it. Next slide. That's what makes it dark. There's nothing that crosses here. There's no natural interaction that allows this side to see that side or that side to this side. We are dark matter and energy to that. But they do link up in one other spot. Next slide. So if you have living sentient beings on this side, if there's a big enough mess of that stuff, we can detect it through gravity. But maybe we could also detect it through our minds. And where do we experience, when you talk to people experiencing ghosts, demons, angels, deities, they might see them, but no one else does. So it's not there. They're seeing them in their mind. It's in your conscious mind that you can have a means of communicating with them. Because down here, we're all the same stuff. So is it surprising it happens in dreams? So that's all I'm saying, is that maybe this is that stuff, and those beings are this. And to them, they are material, and we are non-material. But even to us, we're actually non-material. I wanted to make this elegant, but there's just no way I could. So I'm going to cue the slide, wait for it. Now. Any questions? Yes. Sorry. Well, I think it does see us probably, but it's limited in the same way we are. And if you talk, well, they tell you that. Those non-material beings, if you have a conversation with them. If you talk to people, to them, we are the dream. They see us. Now, some people who will report, and because so now I'm going to go into really weird stuff. When you talk to people who seem not crazy, not in need of medication for psychotic disorder. No, that's not me. Good. Some people I know who are sophisticated people who are university professors in the sciences, no less, who also have experiences and are adept at cultivating these experiences, some of them in lineages. This is often a family ability. And it turns out I didn't know this until late in my mother's stage, but apparently everyone in the family knew that people going back see dead people. And my mother apparently has been seeing dead people my whole life. She just never told me. One of her friends said, I said to her, my mother's talking to dead people. And she said, she's always talking to dead people. She just stopped guarding it, you know? So that happens. And when you talk to people who can cultivate these experiences, sometimes in vaguely or more or less vaguely verifiable fashion, the constant comment is, to us, they seem unreal. From their perspective, we seem unreal. And not all of them are able to communicate and interact with people on this plane. We're talking like the astral plane, whatever that means. They have the same issues that we do. That's okay. Just that last slide. But it sort of makes sense. It's not that we're real and they're experiencing us as the real real. And often what these people say is, no, the other side is more real than this one is. So again, I think it's a complementarity thing. And it all depends on your perspective.
There's a book called Extraordinary Knowing, which is talking about all of it, and the people, scientists, et cetera, who experience this, and then don't say it because there's no context for that to be acknowledged as real. It's a very interesting book.
Yeah.
So far, every talk I've given at the Zendo up through the awareness thing, I've managed to publish.
I'm not intending to try to publish this anytime soon or speak elsewhere about it. At least not yet.
What about the doctor, the surgeon guy, bestseller, best-selling author?
Yeah, aside from being a self-promotional narcissist, but setting that aside, yeah. No, I know, exactly. Yeah. He's a surgeon. Sorry, pathologist speak. He had a near-death experience and saw the other side, et cetera. What's his name? Yeah. He was at Yale, right? Oh, yeah. Somewhere sophisticated. Right. Yeah.
I'm not clear about the embodiment of the dark matter and dark energy. Are you saying, because it sounds a little bit like you're personifying what we understand as God, you know, the way we sort of, okay, what is God? So you're talking about this dark, unmeasurable as being, as following the same laws.
Mm. Right. Mathematically, I suspect that the math of self-organization is independent of what it is describing. So I have no really good reason to say that stuff would be conditioned by other mathematics. But I'm not saying they have bodies. I'm not saying they live in buildings. I'm not saying that anything about it may be recognizable to anything we have. But when you have these kinds of interactions or talk to people who have these kinds of interactions, what they describe is you're viewing it through the mind. And the way you have a dream that makes no sense, but when you wake up, you try to find a way to describe it, which the moment you do eliminates what you dreamt. But at the same time, so I think we create metaphors out of what's familiar. But that's why descriptors, you know, one of the discussions I've had is when several of us have had an experience of one particular being, but our view is different. Why is that? Don't they have a body? Well, yeah, but if we're only perceiving it here, then my mind, the way I take a dream and will turn it, I'll personalize it. That's my best, you know, guess. Yes.
Are you saying that the dead people that are seen sometimes by your mother or interacting with in all of the lifetime, they are made up of dark matter, they have become dark matter, or that she's explaining the fact that she's seeing an anonymous dark matter by giving it a face?
I don't know. And, you know, where I can't make a leap here and I don't know what to do with it, where I get lost, is if we talk about a ghost. So am I saying that if I have an out-of-body experience, is that an actual, do I have a dark matter, dark energy body that travels? And that all of us have that. And there's some intimate relationship that we don't understand between our kind of material and that kind of material, so that when we're born, they cohere and can separate and recohere, or separate and that's death. I don't know. Where I would go to try and figure this out is the Tibetan literature on like what transits from life to life. But that's all metaphors. So I get stuck there. I'm much happier talking about fairies and elves than I am about souls and ghosts. So I don't know.
Was your mother interacting with dark matter?
The ghosts, I'm not sure. The other beings, I would say probably yes.
So there is some transitioning from one side of the
shark. I don't know. Presumably, it sounds like there is, but I just don't know how to speak about that with any precision, at least not yet.
But if the evidence for there being some dark matter that is out there, part of it is that people have these experiences, if that's the evidence that you're using, then...
No, what I'm saying is people have these experiences, and I've had no way to fit that into this rather elaborate cosmology I've set up. What do I do with those things? Do I, you know, a typical scientist these days would say, I'm not studying that. and I don't want to be that kind of coward. And I don't want to say, that doesn't really exist. That's what happened with all our stem cell stuff. Cells don't do that. Yes, they do. So this stuff is out there. Do I ignore the evidence for it, or do I try to find some way to extend my hypothesis to encompass it? That's what I'm trying to do. So I'm very incomplete. And this is the stuff where I'm really at a loss. I don't know. What's the relationship of a projected astral body to the body it's coming from? I don't know. Is it this? It could be. But that raises all sorts of other questions that I really don't, you know, the intermaterial physiology of, it's hard enough bacteria in human cells.
But so how deterministic do human beings end up? Are we all just like ants marching along with a little random is thrown in?
Mass extinction.
Waiting for mass extinction. Is that the way of this life?
Kind of. But the thing is, we're in a zendo. The point of our practice isn't to figure out how to better organize ourselves more calmly with less anxiety and depression and more attentively so we can live a more productive life. A point of our practice is to be able to, okay. From a Tibetan standpoint, they talk about wisdom and compassion being the two pillars of Buddhist practice. What do they mean by wisdom? Seeing the world as it is without delusion. It doesn't mean seeing it in the right way that allows you to accomplish something. It's seeing it without delusion. And seeing it without delusion means seeing it for what this is, exactly as it is, and at the same time, just as fully and deeply seeing it for the reverse. There's no separation. Everything is intimate and interdependent and eternal and. And at the same time, the moment you get stuck in that because like, oh, made it, no, we're also a bunch of bodies listening to each other. Don't get stuck there. And it's that complementarity thing. You need both. So a point of our practice isn't to get an outcome or to have our civilization survive better without Trump or whatever. It's just, can you see the world for what it is? And what the world is that side. And to me, the scientific imperative of is, well, we've got this all this other stuff we haven't fit together. Can I fit it together? But it's about seeing things without delusion. So yeah, who the hell knows? You know, one of us could walk out on the street and get hit by a car. Take that in your Buddhist pipe and smoke it, you know? Yeah.
There are people too who have this capacity for sort of distant knowing where space and time don't interfere.
Clairvoyance and precognition.
Yeah. That's what this book is about.
And it's measurable. If you look at the work of coming out mostly from the IONS Institute of Noetic Studies, Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut, had an awakening experience on the way back from the moon. That was so profound, he was like, I need to put all my effort into figuring out what that was about. And he set up this institute. And the director of research is a guy named Dean Radin, R-A-D-I-N, who's just so charming and sweet and eloquent and a rock hard scientist. And he's done massive amounts of data analysis of all the studies that have been published, as well as performing his own studies with his team out there. The most interesting thing that they're working on now, and I've seen the preliminary data, is so that wave-particle duality thing from the quantum stuff that I mentioned before. The idea is that if you send a light wave of photons or electrons, a beam, through two slits, if they're behaving like particles, they'll form two light beams on the projection screen behind. So if you look at them, they behave like particles. But if you don't look at them as they're going through the slits, they act like waves, and you get a diffraction pattern like what happens when waves meet at the ocean, and you see these sort of curly structures extending in all directions. And then you look, and it collapses down to particles again. So the act of conscious observation is what determines whether these are waves or particles. And that's where the quantum physicists were saying, we're stuck now. Mind comes first. What kind of conscious observation? Do you just have a movie projector sitting there catching things? Is that enough? Well, someone's going to review the movie, so you haven't taken the person out of it. So what they've been doing is, and they've got the most state, no one argues with the state-of-the-art aspects of how they can make a shielded room that nothing can communicate out of. And they have the experiment happening there, and they put someone in another room over there, and they say, and they tell them, when the light goes on, direct your attention at the beams you can't see. And when they do that, they get a collapse of the wave function to particles. And they've done it from around the other side of the planet, non-locality, distance doesn't matter. And to do that, they have to do it through computers, which they have to get aligned so that the signal to tell them to concentrate and the information coming back, they can align all that, whatever. So it's this big computer network. So they could also put a fake person being told to concentrate, and it's actually just a computer. So does that do it? No, that doesn't collapse the wave function. It has to be a person somewhere on the planet aiming their attention there. Now, everyone, if you do this for a general population, clairvoyance, precognition, this kind of thing, it all turns out to come around to 51 to 53%. So if you do, if you're gonna predict whether a coin is going to come up heads or tails and do 10,000, it should come up 5,000 wrong, 5,000 right. It's always 5,010 right. There's always a little bit that's statistically meaningful. And he was on Stephen Colbert once, and so it's like 51 to 53%. And he said, well, that's not a lot. 51 to 53%, that's not much. And he pointed out in that particular year, well, that's what Obama won the election by. So there's a significant difference. And why would we have that ability? Well, wouldn't it be evolutionarily advantageous to have a little bit of a presentiment that the tiger is about to leap out of that bush? So maybe it's selected for. But meditators, the percentage goes up, measurably between 55 and 65%. So that's a reason to have Buddhist practice.
And the people who do it, who are able to do it, talk about the fact of withdrawing into that meditative experience.
Right. And then, yeah. And then there's also, well, you know, some people can sit down and play chopsticks. Other people, at a glance, can play Mozart. And other people are Mozart. So there are occasional adepts that can do it 90%, 95%. It's the same with experiencing other beings. All of us have that ability. To some small degree, it can be trained to increase, and some people have gifts.
What's the name of that institute that was
running the research? IONS, IONS, Institute of Noetic Studies. You had a question that I ran over. And then we'll clean up the Zendo, and I can hang around and keep talking if you want.
I'm curious on the idea of impermanence, and how does, for instance, individuation and mind experience that one has in this materialism body and lifetime then pass through this dark column you have there. And I was thinking of it, I'm just curious how it happens or how can we explain it, because for instance in my own meditative experience it seems to kind of melt away of anything that individuates me as a person, the more space opens and I lose touch with it, and that's why I get in trouble. And I lose completely touch with it. So it's curious to me that how, let's say, the ghosts or the people that go into this other realm, or these other dimensions of scales, are able to maintain this individuality of the person who they were prior to, let's say, on this side of the table. I'm just curious how that happens, because it seems like it melts away.
So am I. Curious, that is. You know, this is the perpetually perplexing thing when you hear Tibetan Buddhists talking about this, the ones who know. It's sort of like something transits, but none of it is memory. None of it is the life that came before. But what's the test for reincarnation? It's memories. So I get stuck. And part of it is, I think there are some things that we just, our human language is not sufficient to perhaps encompass this, maybe. Or maybe we just don't have the concepts or the tools necessary. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's a hard stop for me too. I don't know. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.